This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has been controversial since it filled with roughly 800 terror suspects and accused Taliban fighters 5 years ago after the U.S. incursion into Afghanistan. There have been allegations of prisoner abuse, as well as complaints and litigation over detainees' access to lawyers, the courts, and even the information that led to their arrest. Our guest, Clive Stafford Smith, is a defense attorney who represents more than 50 detainees at Guantanamo. He's written a new book called The 8 o'clock Ferry to the Windward Side, Seeking Justice in Guantanamo Bay. Later in the show, we'll speak with Captain Pat McCarthy, the government's chief lawyer in Guantanamo, where the number of detainees is now down to about 330. Clive Stafford Smith is a British-born American citizen who heads an organization called Reprieve, which works on death penalty cases and provides legal assistance to what it calls prisoners denied justice in the name of the war on terror. I spoke to Stafford Smith about his work at Guantanamo and asked him to describe the place.
The whole area, it's a bit bigger than Manhattan, and there's the big bay in the middle. On the one side, you've got the airport and the place we stay, called the Combined Bachelor's Quarters, a slightly odd name. And you take this ferry across. On the other side, there's the big base. There's all sorts of things like McDonald's, and then there's the camp down the bottom. And it's just a huge, small American town, really.
And how are you treated by the military personnel there? How do they feel about a lawyer coming in to defend these folks?
You know, there are two sides to that. People are very nice and professional, I think, by and large. On the other hand, there's an overriding sense, and one soldier told me this, that they had been told that we, the lawyers, were the enemy of the mission. And that's very much the view. The view is that you should keep pesky people like lawyers and journalists as well out of the whole process, which is very sad. And there is a hostility. I've been threatened with being locked up myself down there, which I don't like at all.
Give us a sense of the procedure for arranging a visit. How much more difficult is it than visiting someone in an American prison? I know you've done a lot of work in prisons in the United States.
It's enormous. You have to go way back and recognize that actually we're not allowed, we weren't told in the beginning who the prisoners were down there. And we asked the military to just tell us, because there was a group of lawyers who felt very strongly, and I was among them, that we needed to bring the rule of law to that place. But the military took the position they wouldn't even tell us the prisoners they were holding. So the first challenge we had was to identify the folk there. Then the military said we couldn't represent them without someone's permission. We say, hey, well, how about letting us talk to the prisoners? They say you can't. So I had to travel around the Middle East, getting people to give permission to us, family members. Then, of course, we still sued. It took 2.5 years before the U.S. Supreme Court let us go down there as lawyers. It was an endless, endless process. Now, of course, it's a bit better because the Supreme Court has ordered it, but it's been a monumental battle.
There were about 800 or so prisoners originally. It's down to 330. How many there have actually seen a lawyer now?
There's still over 100 prisoners of the 330 who haven't seen lawyers, and that's been down to the fact that we've had such a hard time getting through to them. Of the other couple of hundred, look, there's a real problem even establishing trust. I'm American. I know it sometimes doesn't sound like it on the radio, but we all have to be American citizens to go there. And you go in and you say, oh, hi, I'm an American lawyer. I'm here to help you. Doesn't necessarily immediately establish trust with some chap who's been abused for 6 years in this American detention center. And there are other things, too, that make it very difficult. The interrogators down there go out of their way to make the prisoners not trust the lawyers. One time I went in to see a guy called Shakarama, and he looks at me and he says, you're Jewish, aren't you? And, honestly, I didn't know my dad was Jewish until I was 37, and I was quite surprised that he knew this. It turns out the interrogators had been telling him about the lawyers being Jewish to try and get him not to work with the lawyers. Next time I went down there, one of my clients said, I've been told by my interrogator you like having sex with men. there's just these absurd things that are done to make it very difficult for us to establish trust with the prisoners.
How do some of the restrictions on your interactions with prisoners and restrictions on the kind of information you may have access to affect your work?
The overarching theme about Guantanamo is one of censorship and secrecy. From the very beginning, the whole place was meant to be secret. That's the whole point of it. So, for example, when I go down and visit my clients, I can take notes. I'm sitting there with them. I can write my notes. but I'm not allowed to take them with me. And so I have to put my notes in an envelope that's sealed and then sent by mail to Washington, to a secret place there, where if I want those notes out publicly, I have to pass them through the censors. So anything I talk to you about today, for example, has to have been through the United States censors.
Let's talk about who is at Guantanamo. You know, I think a lot of Americans, when after 9/11 and after the attacks in Afghanistan, when you know, had the belief that hundreds of these combatants were taken to Guantanamo, and while there certainly may have been some people who were innocently caught up in them, that it was an extraordinary situation, and they were prepared to tolerate some, you know, some different procedures. As you can best tell, how many of those who were taken to Guantanamo were actually captured on the battlefield?
Well, it's a very, very small number. And I should say this, that when I first went down there, I shared what you said. I thought the vast majority of them were going to have been involved in fighting in Afghanistan. And, you know, my thing was the principle that we should give everyone a fair hearing. But I thought, honestly, that I was going to have a lot of explaining to do for some of these prisoners. But it turns out that there's a very, very small number. And when you learn the facts, it's actually quite logical. What was going on was this. The U.S. was dropping these leaflets all over Pakistan and Afghanistan, offering $5,000 bounties. And $5,000 in that neck of the woods is a lot of money. It would translate in American terms to about $250,000 to what we're used to getting paid. So, you know, think for a minute what you would do if there was someone you didn't like, who was some foreigner, who you were just being asked to say, oh, I saw him in Tora Bora, and you get $250,000. The problem was a vast number of people got turned in with one of those stories that were just false. Well, then we followed up with these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, which, you know, is really a euphemism for torture, and we start abusing people. And, of course, they'll confess pretty quickly that it was true. Yeah, I was in Tora Bora. But then that gets you a one-way ticket to Guantanamo. Unfortunately, there are no lawyers, there's no courts, there's no way of checking out whether it's true. And we've ended up having just a huge number of people there who had nothing to do with any fighting. And, you know, you see that now. Even amongst the allegations made by the U.S. military, there's a very small proportion who are alleged to have actually been fighting anybody.
You said that a lot of people who really were innocent of any connections to terrorism have been caught up, were caught by forces given to the United States and ended up in Guantanamo Bay. What is the review process for seeing whether the accusations against them are credible? Aren't there regular review tribunals which at least review some of that material and are designed to weed out those who have been mistakenly captured?
Well, unfortunately, those tribunals are not up to much. The prisoners are not allowed lawyers. They're not allowed to know the evidence against them. They're not allowed to know many of the allegations against them. And, you know, we have continually asked just to be given a list of what the allegations are to be able to rebut them. And those allegations change over time so much. Each time, for example, with Sami Alhaj, who's an Al Jazeera journalist I represent down there, they've come up with new allegations. I've proved those allegations are false, and then they come up with something else. The most recent things that they gave to him on September the 11th of this year alleges that his terrorist training, if you'll believe it, involves the following, and I quote, "The detainee was trained in the use of cameras by Al Jazeera," end quote. Now, you know, I stipulate that's true. Of course that's true. He worked for them, but it's not a crime. And yet, this is the allegation of training that's meant to prove he's a terrorist.
You know, what are the difficulties with dealing with the detainees at Guantanamo is that this isn't, you know, an American criminal trial. I mean, and one of the reasons in the American criminal justice system that defendants are entitled to, you know, discovery of information against them and they're protected from, you know, self-incrimination and the government has to prove its case is that the government in a civilian setting has enormous powers, the powers to compel evidence and conduct searches and subpoena bank records and other evidence. And, of course, in this setting, the government may be operating in Afghanistan or Pakistan, doesn't have all those powers. And so one could argue that the procedures ought to be different. And, of course, one model is prisoners captured in war. But given that it's not exactly like an American criminal setting, what kind of procedure should be used?
There are some people in Guantanamo who have apparently done some really bad things. Let's not pretend that everyone down there is whiter than white, Snow White. But these people, for example, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is one example. He boasted on Al Jazeera that he was behind the 9/11, the horrendous crime of 9/11. Now, one can make the argument that he shouldn't get a normal trial, but of course you could try him very easily. All you have to do is play the videotape of him boasting on Al Jazeera to any jury in the world that convict him, and, you know, goodness knows what that vote should happen to him. The problem with what we've been doing is that the government, the Bush administration, has been saying this is a whole different world and we can't follow the rules that have worked quite well for the U.S. for 200 years. And they've ended up abusing Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, torturing him. There's no other word for it. Now, the idea that we can bring him to trial is so much more difficult. We could have brought him to justice very easily before, but now the reason the government doesn't want an open trial for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is because they don't want this evidence of torture to come out. That's the only reason. There's no other justification for it.
And if I could interrupt, how do we know Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was tortured?
Well, he's tried to say it. There's been various statements, of course, by U.S. officials about how he survived waterboarding for longer than any other person. Well, waterboarding is a form of torture, as Senator John McCain has so eloquently said. But he tried to say it in his little combatant status review tribunal down there in Guantanamo, and the government censored it all. They allowed him to rant on about the terrible things he'd done, which is fine. He's going to nail his own coffin shut. But the government very much doesn't want you to hear about the torture. Now, that's wrong. That's just not what America's all about.
One of the things you do in this book is you look at the Nuremberg trials after World War II as an example of dealing with war criminals. What lessons do you think are instructive that episode for the current challenges facing
It's fascinating on many levels. I mean, the first thing is, you know, I live here in Britain. I'm half British, half American. And it was really good for me to see that after World War II, the Americans were clearly the good guys. I mean, the U.S. is getting a lot of flack right now. But after World War II, Winston Churchill didn't want to bother with trials. He just wanted to string them all up. Stalin, of course, said we should have trials and then kill them all. He obviously knew the outcome of the trials. And it was the Americans who insisted on fair trials. And the Nuremberg tribunals are really quite fantastic. They gave people very fair processes, and 35% of the people charged ended up being acquitted. And that really set a hallmark. It was what America was about. And I don't see any reason whatsoever that we can't do that again today. I think these arguments that somehow the world is so different today compared to then are very, very dubious. And the Bush administration, I'm afraid, has thrown away the goodwill that we gained after World War II.
Well, one difference I can see is that those trials occurred after, you know, the Axis governments had fallen and the Allies had complete control in Germany and could, you know, talk to whoever they wanted to, get whatever evidence they wanted to. Maybe not so easy for the United States government today to accumulate the evidence against some of these folks in places that they don't have free reign.
People might argue that, but I think it's a dubious position to take because the difference today also is that we've got television, we've got mass communication. And so, you know, these people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi Ben al-Sheikh, people like that have been on television. We don't need any more evidence than that. And one thing I did when all of these people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed were in secret prisons was we put together the evidence that could be used to prosecute him that was just in the public domain. And I've got this long memo. It's about 20 pages of stuff that could be proved against him that needs absolutely nothing that's secret. So people elevate all these reasons why we can't be fair, we can't afford to live up to our ideals, but I just don't think they're valid.
What do you hear from your clients at Guantanamo Bay about the treatment they have received from the jailers there?
Well, I mean, it runs a gamut, and it's not only what the U.S. personnel have done, but of course we've rendered people to different places. Let me give you the example of Binyam Mohammed. He's a British resident and he was seized in Pakistan. He was then rendered by the CIA on a plane. We got the plane logs, we know the people on the plane, and he was rendered to Morocco, where he spent 18 months and they tortured him and they took a razor blade to his genitals, for goodness sake. and they also did some other pretty unspeakable things to him. They then rendered him back to Kabul, to a dark prison there. It's called the Dark Prison, and they kept him in this other awful medieval place for another 5 months.
And the government doesn't deny that he was taken to Morocco.
No, they don't, and they can't. And indeed, we know that they've got photographs of some of his injuries. They've never let it out, and I wish they would. They should. But, you know, those are things. When I went to law school in New York many, many years ago, it never occurred to me that one day I would sit across the table with another human being and talk to him about my government, the United States, being responsible for taking razor blades to his genitals and other horrible things like that. I mean, that's one extreme. And this is where the Bush administration has cost you and me an enormous amount of international goodwill by dredging up this medieval notion of torture as some solution to our problems. So there's that. And then as you go down the line, those sorts of things, those really extreme things, of course, don't happen in Guantanamo, and they certainly don't today. But there have been some acts in Guantanamo that have been pretty much beyond the pale, and there are still things going on. And anyone who pretends there isn't, you know, I've seen the results of them. I'll give you one example. It's nothing like the razor blade. But Sami Alhaj, my Al Jazeera guy, is being force-fed. Today, I think, is the 289th or 90th day of his hunger strike. And he's only on a hunger strike for one thing. He says, look, don't trust me. Just give me a fair trial. If you don't believe what I'm saying, give me a fair trial. But if you don't do that, let me go. That's all he's asking. Now, the military doesn't want him on a hunger strike, although that's a sort of peaceful protest. So what they've done is they force-feed him twice a day, but they don't do it the way doctors do it. They don't do it in the kindest way possible. Instead, they stick a tube up his nose, 110 centimeters long, and each time they do that, they strap him in this chair, they force-feed him, and then they pull it back out of his nose. And I tried that because I wanted to see what my clients were going through, and I can tell you it's excruciating. But General Craddock went in the New York Times and said this was being done intentionally to make it, quote, inconvenient for the prisoners to keep on hunger strike. It's torturous, and it's totally beneath us. We shouldn't be doing that stuff.
You know, you can go to the Defense Department website, and they make the case that enhanced interrogation techniques have led to very valuable information. And they also note, we'll list former prisoners of Guantanamo, which were released and have returned to active, what they say is active hostile actions against the United States and its allies. I mean, what about the case they make that, A, there are really bad guys there, and B, that this aggressive interrogation has yielded very useful information?
Well, let's take the first one first, which is they say there are very bad guys there. I think there are some. I've mentioned one or two. But, you know, what you've got to recognize is that when they say that they've let people free and those people have gone on to fight, they let free a whole bunch of people who really were in the Taliban, who were from Afghanistan. They let go the Taliban minister to Pakistan, for goodness sake, whereas they didn't let free an awful lot of people who were just swept up in this whole process and had nothing to do with anything. And they did that because their intelligence has been so bad.
The United States government established military commissions to conduct trials of some of these detainees. And then the procedure was thrown out by the courts. And then a new military commission statute was enacted by Congress last year. And they're now making preparations to conduct trials of some defendants at Guantanamo. Give us your view of to what extent these represent a thorough and fair review of the facts.
You know, there's no way in which those proceedings are fair. I've taken part in one of the procedures. Again, it was in Binyam Mohammed's case. And the client is not allowed to know all the allegations against him, you know, this secret evidence that we're not allowed to talk about with him. We're not allowed to know some of the evidence against him. And when you talk about prosecuting Binyam Mohammed based on torture evidence that was exacted out of him at the end of a razor blade, you know, that's the wrong century we're in.
And from what you've directly observed, I mean, you've been to Guantanamo, 20 times or more?
Roughly, I think 19, yeah.
Is it a better run place than it used to be?
Oh, there's no doubt that it's better in many, many ways than it used to be. And I think that's because there's been public oversight now much more through the lawyers and the media. But there are still huge, huge problems down there. And the biggest one right now is this mistreatment of the prisoners over hunger strike. But on the other hand, you know, there's only one way to solve that, really, and that's to open it up and open it up to be a public prison rather than the secret place. And it's the secrecy, I think, is most difficult, most troubling.
Well, what do you mean when you say, I mean, we can't walk into any prison in the United States. I wouldn't describe them as open places. What do you mean by a secret prison or an open prison?
Well, what I mean is one where there's free access for the prisoners to have access to lawyers if they need it, one where there are judges who are actually meaningfully allowed to review the conditions down there. I don't know what the U.S. military is so afraid of, why they won't let good, upstanding American judges oversee what they're doing. I mean, what have they got to hide? That's the real issue. We should treat it like any other prison.
Well, Clive Stafford Smith, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
Clive Stafford Smith represents more than 50 detainees at Guantanamo Bay. His new book is The 8 O'Clock Ferry to the Windward Side.